It's time for the Rink Rats with Ryan the Hockey Guy Wallace and Jesse Granger.
Rink Rats, Ryan the Hockey Guy, Jesse Granger. Jesse, you are back from the East Coast. How long did it take you to get reacclimated to Vegas?
You know what's weird? I don't know if I don't get jet lag or if I just don't know what jet lag is and I have it and don't know. Because I've never, like, I fly all over the place in like three different time zones and unless I've had it and not known, I've never had jet lag. So I felt fine when I got home. And I was tired because the night flying back, I didn't sleep except for on the plane.
Right.
Which is never the highest quality sleep. Sitting up with your neck cranked against the window.
You didn't go first class?
Ha! Come on. Have you seen the difference in first? Like, it's unbelievable. A $180 plane ticket will be $1,000 for first class.
Sure,
like, really? Yeah. Is it $900 better? Because I walk past first class when I'm walking through, and it doesn't look that much better.
I don't know. I don't fly enough to answer that question. Like, I'd rather get in a truck and drive across the country than sit in an airplane, to be honest. So I'm the wrong guy to ask. Although I wasn't necessarily talking about jet lag. I was talking about Jesse Granger and your fear of cold weather. Your absolute disdain for anything snow related. Outside of hockey.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean,
you don't like it. You're not a fan of cold weather.
I like snow when I have no responsibilities with the snow. So, like, for example, go to morning skate at Madison Square Garden. By the way, that building, greatest structure I've ever stepped foot in.
Really?
Arena, stadium, building. I've never stepped foot in a building that was more impressive than Madison Square Garden.
You know, it's funny because I haven't been there. And I always remember watching games at Madison Square Garden, like just watching them on TV. It felt different, like the shadows and all of the things that you come to know from watching hockey games on TV. The Garden just seemed different.
It's fantastic. The press box is the most impressive thing I've ever seen in my life.
So you got your own monitor.
Yeah, every person sitting there, it's glass. The table that your laptop and everything sits on is glass, and there's a TV underneath the glass. Each person has their own individual TV, but the entire building of MSG, not just the arena, because it's huge. It's on top of Penn Station, which is like the travel hub of the entire East Coast, all these trains underground. The ice is on the fifth floor, which every other arena that I've been to, the ice is on the ground floor. It's on the event level. At Madison Square Garden, the ice is on the fifth of 10 floors. So the press box is 10 stories high. Five above the ice. It's unbelievable.
What?
Yes. The ice is on the fifth floor.
But
it's the building is massive.
You've exploded my brain right now.
Yeah,
what's on one through four?
Just stuff that's like beneath the arena and then also like rooms that are beneath the arena and also that's the subway. I think like the bottom couple floors are down into Penn Station where you like buy your subway tickets. It's insane.
Yeah, that's insane. So I'm not a big that's giving me anxiety thinking about
so
it.
So I could get to my hotel. I stayed at Times Square. I could get to my hotel to MSG with only walking outside for about 10 feet because I could walk 10 feet out of my hotel room, go underneath the ground to the subway, hop on the train and then come out underneath Madison Square Garden. But back to the snow. So we get out of morning skate at MSG and it's snowing harder than I've ever seen it snow in my entire life. And I grew up, my first 16 years of life were in Colorado, in the mountains, in Colorado Springs. So I've seen snow.
Yeah.
It was snowing so unbelievably hard. I thought it was cool. So I walked back to my hotel instead of taking the subway. So
Classic mistake.
Like 16 blocks. No, it was fun.
Oh, it was good.
Like I said, snow is fun. Because I don't have to chisel my windshield. I don't have to warm my car up for an hour before I go to work. I don't have to shovel my driveway. That's the stuff that makes snow suck. If you can just look at the snow and enjoy it and not have to be the guy chiseling the snow off the windshield, give me snow.
I've never really been in snow. Like, I've seen snow. I've had snow happen around me, but I've never actually been in it. And I want so desperately, just one time. Because I think that's all it's going to take is one time before I'm like, fuck this, no way.
Snow is, like I said, it's fun to look at. It's not fun to live in it.
Yeah, I want so badly just one time to be in snow and then realize how stupid I am when I'm like, oh, no, I'd love to be in a place that has snow. It'd be great. then again, I think at some point in time, I will take the family up to Buffalo and spend at least part of a day or two there during the winter.
Yeah.
Because that's all you need, because it never stops snowing in Buffalo.
Yeah,
that's true. Literally does not stop. Since going back there this summer, I have kept an eye on it, and it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
It just doesn't stop.
But yeah, no, New York was fun. That was definitely one of the most fun cities I've been to on the road. I had a blast.
Food was good?
Fantastic. Tried some New York pizza.
What's your hot take there?
So I'm a huge fan of Chicago deep dish pizza. When I go to Chicago, I always get me a deep dish pizza.
Yep.
I had never had New York pizza from New York, so I made it a mission to find the best place.
Hold on. Did you go to Sbarro?
Oh, yeah, from The Office, yeah. This is my favorite pizza place in New York, and it's Sbarro. Yeah. Michael Scott. No, I did not.
Oh, man.
I asked around, and apparently, like, there's a million pizza places that are awesome, but apparently the one right across the street from MSG, it's called Suprema.
Uh-huh.
It's supposed to be one of the best ones, and I went and ate there. Blows Chicago out of the water. Sorry, really? All my Chicago people. New York pizza is better than Chicago pizza.
Jesse Granger providing all the hot takes.
Hot takes.
So we'll get away from food here for a minute, and we'll get into the Golden Knights. Obviously, since we last talked to you all, and sorry, holidays happen, and we like our family sometimes, the Golden Knights were pretty bad. They were delightfully average, maybe is the best way to put it. So far, early on in the year. And then they go on a little bit of a run. Marc-Andre Fleury leaves the team for personal reasons. We come to find out later that it was because of the passing of his father, Andre Fleury. And in that stretch with Marc-Andre Fleury gone, Malcolm Subban steps in, plays pretty well considering how Malcolm Subban's season started for the Golden Knights. And Vegas rattles off 4 straight wins. Then they get points in 5. And that point streak comes to an end last night with a loss to the Rangers. So that's getting everybody back up to speed. What's the most impressive thing to you? What has stood out the most to you during the 4-game win streak, 5-game point streak, however you want to break it down, but that period of time where it seemed like the Golden Knights were playing a bit better?
I think they were finally scoring goals there for a while, and then it disappeared here in these last 2 games against the Rangers and obviously getting shut out against the Islanders on Long Island.
You can't say at Long Island or in Long Island.
Yeah,
it's on
Long Island. On Long Island, they obviously struggled against the Islanders, but everybody does to score against the Islanders, and then they get shut out at home against a terrible defensive team in the Rangers. So these last 2 games they haven't, but prior to that, it seemed like the floodgates were kind of opening up with the scoring. I mean, Malcolm Subban gets a couple wins that, like, a lot of games that Subban plays, he deserved to win, and he loses 2-1 or 1-0, and where he played a great game and should have got a win but didn't. Well, you had a few of the opposite ones where Malcolm Subban didn't play his best game, but the team scored 4 goals, and they get a win in New Jersey and in Madison Square Garden. The team got some goal support for him. So I was impressed with the goals finally coming, and it was from different guys. It was Alex Tuch having a phenomenal road trip, and he has played really well as of late. We'll see if that continues with this new third line that's going to happen now with all these injuries. But
we'll get there, we promise.
It's nice to see the Golden Knights getting production from Stevenson and from Tuch and guys that aren't William Karlsson and Mark Stone, basically. And we can talk about Mark Stone's struggles, but your top guys are going to go through droughts, and you need the depth scoring to step up when those guys go through their droughts. And I think that up until the last couple games, it has.
Well, the Golden Knights aren't getting scoring from William Karlsson. It's been 10 games without a goal for William Karlsson. Mark Stone, I believe, has 6 points in his last 16 games.
It hasn't been good.
Something in that ballpark. So when you look at the Golden Knights through the course of these first 32 games of the season, there's 50 more games, so there's no room for panicking just yet. But over the course of 32 games, the Golden Knights offense has had parts going at times, but it's never been efficient. It's never been top to bottom. It's never been you get contributions from everyone in the lineup that you're supposed to get contributions from. You're supposed to get contributions offensively from Shea Theodore. You're supposed to get contributions offensively from Nick Hague and Nate Schmidt. I understand Hague is a rookie, but he's also a part of this team, and it looks like a bona fide part of this team. I don't think Nick Hague's coming out of the lineup anytime soon. So you need to get production from your offensive defenseman. That hasn't been there, at least not steadily enough for the Golden Knights. You're not getting production from your bottom six in terms of really much from your fourth line. And it took Cody Glass and it took an injury to Cody Eakin to finally get something out of your third line 28 games into the season. And that coincided with your second line disappearing and your top line getting finally some production from Jonathan Marchessault, but the production from Riley Smith and William Karlsson has fallen off. So it's to me, this offense that when you get these glimpses, when these guys are all going at the same time, when they're rolling four lines, when everyone's where they should be, and you start to see some of that confidence, you look at this team and you say, they've got all the talent in the world. They can score five goals every single night. They legitimately could.
They should be.
They have enough offensive firepower right now, and even enough offense from the blue line to score five goals every single night. But they're not, and they're not coming close to it.
Well, they that's the problem, is they are coming close. Not coming close as in they're scoring close to that many goals. They're coming close as in they're coming close to seven goals a night and only scoring one of them. And that is a major, major issue. And, like, I don't remember when my story about them not being able to finish their chances came out as in relation to our podcast. Right. I don't know if we've talked about it, but, like, I just pulled up the stats real quick on Natural Stat Trick.
Okay.
This team is first in the NHL in scoring chances for at even strength. 741 scoring chances at even strength. The next closest is the Maple Leafs at 705. No one else has over 700 scoring chances this season, and they have 741 at even strength. Okay, so scoring chances are kind of tough. Let's look at high danger chances. They're second in the NHL with 294 high danger chances. The only team with more is the Dallas Stars, and they have one more. So the Golden Knights have the most chances of anyone in the NHL. All right, let's go to goals. And they're not number one, two, three, four. They are 22nd in the NHL in goals for at even strength. That blows my mind.
Number one and number two in scoring chances and high danger chances, respectively. And they're 22nd in the NHL in goals for.
That is unbelievable. And like I said, this team is exceptional at creating chances and exceptionally bad at finishing them.
So at what point do we talk about scoring chances and high danger chances and what constitutes those, right? Because let's be honest. Will Carrier turns the corner, gets in tight, throws a weak backhander to the pads because of his proximity to the net. That's a high danger scoring chance. How many of those are the Golden Knights getting? Like, how many legitimate high danger chances are they getting? Because I'll be honest with you, when you look at the salaries of Mark Stone, Max Pacioretty, I hazard to put William Karlsson in there because he's making under $6 million and he does a lot of different things. But when you look at the salaries of
Karlsson,
the finishers,
Smith, Marchessault is getting Stastny. Like, Marchessault is getting paid slightly less than Karlsson, right?
Slightly more. I think
he's
at $6 million. But
whatever
right
it is, Karlsson's getting paid that to do everything. Marchessault is getting paid what he's getting paid to score goals. 100%. And that's it. Nothing else.
100%. But the problem is, if I want to say that a lot of those scoring chances, or I want to say the high danger ones, are being inflated by little plays around the net that aren't really legitimate chances. Because if that's not the case, the Golden Knights, I can't make the argument that they didn't misjudge the talent. Because you have to finish. Like, yeah. I'm sorry, for the price the Golden Knights are paying right now, for Stone, Stastny, Pacioretty, Marchessault, Karlsson, Smith, they've got to be finishing those chances at a higher success rate because they're just not good enough right now.
Yeah. And like, I understand the argument of high danger chances and scoring chances are not a perfect system at all. Like, it's not even close. If you watch a game and then you'll look at Natural Stat Trick after the first period and you'll say, what? They had four high danger chances? What are you talking about? Like, it's not perfect. But if you look at every other team in the league and where they rank in high danger chances and where they rank in goals, it's pretty damn good. There is a strong, strong, strong correlation between scoring chances and goals.
Sure.
Otherwise, if there wasn't, Why would Natural Statric even keep these stats? Why would every reporter that covers hockey be looking at them? Clearly, there is a correlation. And if you go onto, like, Charting Hockey does a great job of it. Right. If you go onto his charts, you put on the y-axis, you put goals for, x-axis, you put scoring chances for. It's a pretty straight line. There is a correlation there. And then there's the Golden Knights way over here on the top left corner where it says unlucky. And the Golden Knights say, like, last night, hockey gods weren't on our side, puck luck. And like, yeah, that does – hockey has a lot of variance compared to other sports. But if it's happening to the same team every time all season long, eventually you got to say maybe it's not puck luck and they're just not finishing these chances. They're really good at creating them and not as good at finishing them.
So where do they go from here? I guess that's the big question, because you talk about – scoring chances, you talk about where they are in relation to the rest of the league in terms of generating offense. They generate a ton of it.
Yeah.
They generate enough of it to win hockey games. And it's not an overreaction to one game. It's not an overreaction to last night against the Rangers. It is 32 games in which the Golden Knights offense has not been anywhere close to consistent or good enough to win hockey games at a reasonable clip for this team in the NHL.
Well, and that's the thing, is they're 22nd in even strength goals. For some teams, that would be okay. But for a team that's using all of its cap space on forwards and Marc-Andre Fleury, I mean, the defensemen on the Golden Knights, there's only one team in the NHL, and I can't remember which one it is, but it's a team that's not pressed against the cap like the Golden Knights. But they're 30th in the NHL in spending on defensemen. The Golden Knights don't spend a ton of money on their defensemen. Nate Schmidt's the highest paid defenseman on the team, and he's making 5.9. They've got a bunch of guys who are making 3, 2, 3, 2. Nick Holden, John Merrill, Derek Englund, Nick Hague. They're not making a lot of money.
Nope.
So the reason all those guys aren't making any money is because they're paying it all to the forwards. So if you're going to pay, like you said, the top six of this team is insanely high paid. Mm-hmm. They don't have any $12 million players, but they've got a lot of $6 million players and up. And that much money can't be spent to be 22nd in the NHL in scoring.
You make an interesting point in terms of the Golden Knights are built to be a team that is led by their top six. That's how they win hockey games.
Yeah.
They get stellar goaltending from a future Hall of Famer. They can outscore teams. That's how they are built to win. That's how they became, or at least were built, to be Stanley Cup contenders. Toronto Maple Leafs were built in the same way. They're struggling so far this year. Is it flawed? Is it flawed construction to be that all in on your top end, top six, and leaving yourself susceptible to less than ideal bottom six and a defense that has a couple of good pieces, but not those pieces that take you over the top?
I will say this. It's certainly possible that it's flawed, but to me, the biggest, like Toronto and Vegas, yeah, they both are very forward heavy and they don't play a lot of defense, but this is what I would say. The huge difference is I think Vegas paid all of its forwards and they paid defensive minded forwards so that they could not pay the defense. So like Toronto, they're like, okay, we're not going to pay our defenseman anything. We're going to put all the money in forwards and we're just going to outscore everyone 6-5 every night.
Sure.
Vegas, on the other hand, isn't trying to win games 6-5. They're actually paying Mark Stone, William Karlsson, Riley Smith, Paul Stastny, Max Pacioretty. These are all forwards who have been in Selke consideration, have been known as defensively minded forwards. So like, I think when George McPhee and Kelly McCrimmon construct this team and they say, okay, we're paying our forwards an insane amount of money, but they're all so good defensively that we can get away with mediocre defensemen and it equals a good defense because the forwards are so good in their own end,
so
I
let's,
think.
Let's talk about defensive system then. Gerard Gallant went from a one-on-one, man-on-man type coverage in the defensive zone to more of a zone coverage in which you've got a lot more switching in terms of players as they're going high to low, low to high. You don't see individual skaters sticking with individual men. You see, much like how the Golden Knights defend a penalty kill, where they've been very successful through the first 2.5 years of existence. So is that why do you think it took so long to get there? I guess, and the reason I ask that is, I think a lot of it has to do with foot speed. I think a lot of it has to do with individual foot speed and not having the types of players that you had over the first 2 years where you could go man on man.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter who forced the turnover. You had enough speed up and down the lineup to get into transition and create some chances 2-on-1, 3-on-2.
I think the reason it took so long to go to that is because Gerard Gallant likes simplicity. And it's worked.
Gallant.
Loves simplicity. And it's worked for 2.5 years. And I don't want to say it hasn't worked this year. Like, I don't know if it's the system or not. But I will say that man on man is much, much simpler because that's your guy.
Sure.
If he scores, it's your fault.
Right.
Stay on him. Don't let him get the puck. If he gets the puck, you close the distance. You make life as difficult as you can for him. Take away his time and space and don't let him do anything with it.
100%.
Whereas when you play a zone, there's a lot more communication. There are a lot more goals where there are mix-ups. There are a lot more times where a guy walks in completely unchecked to the goalie like Artemi Panarin did last night. Just... if it would have been a shootout, I don't know if he would have had any more time. He literally walked in and sniped Subban McNabb was screening him.
McNabb was coming out to defend and then doesn't make the block on the shot.
Yeah, there are pros and cons to both, but I honestly think the zone is going to help them.
I think it does too, and insofar as... you're depending a lot on Derek Englund. You're depending a lot on Braden McNabb. You're depending a lot on Nick Hague. And I'm not trying to lump Hague in with those other two guys. But Nick Hague's biggest concern is always going to be his skating.
Yeah.
And I think this preserves him a little bit more for those neutral zone transition type chances. The other thing I think it does, just in terms of conserving energy for some of your other defensemen, the other thing is... you want Mark Stone, Max Pacioretty high in the zone, right? Like, you want those guys pressuring defensemen. Or if you have rovers like Roman Josi who go down low, and then you've got forwards dropping back in support, you want Mark Stone and Max Pacioretty and William Karlsson and Riley Smith up high in the zone to create some turnovers and possibly exploit a forward back on defense. And those are the things that I think the Golden Knights are trying to manufacture when it comes to their offense. This was a team that was able to beat you in transition because they were forechecking the hell out of you for a year and a half. They didn't know any other way. They couldn't beat teams down low in zone on the cycle. They just couldn't do it. They didn't have the players. They didn't have the personnel to do that year one. They simply didn't.
No.
They did have the personnel to skate you out of the building and beat you in transition. And right now, they're kind of stuck between those two systems.
I agree.
You've got the top line, which can forecheck the shit out of you and create chances. You've got the second line that wants to play in the zone on a cycle. They don't necessarily want to play in transition. I have no idea what to make of the third line because it's been different every single game, it seems.
Yeah.
And the fourth line is, again, a line that's got enough skating that it could do something in transition, but they're not going to create the types of offensive chances in transition that are going to be high yielding. So they dump pucks in, they get it along the boards, and they just kind of buy time.
Yeah. I think the two biggest positives offensively for the zone that they're playing in their defensive zone are, one, breakouts are simpler because the guy is in the same spot every time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because they're in a zone, they kind of stay in their area that's theirs, so that when you do turn the puck over, if you're a defenseman, you know who is on the left board, you know who's on the right board, you know who's kind of roving in the center, you know where everyone is, so it makes breakouts easier. And two, like you said, it conserves energy because you aren't chasing people around, so that you can use that energy offensively and jump it. Like Derek Englund had the breakaway game. And like in that game, he jumped into the play a bunch of times. And I asked him after the game. And by the way, I sat in the locker room I've never been in the locker room by myself after everyone had gone. Like Turk was doing the press conference in the other room. I just stayed in the locker room because they asked me to. So I'm just like sitting there all alone. And McNabb walks in and he's like, are you like waiting for something? Like, are you lost basically? Like, why are you still in here? So anyways,
he's seen you every day for the last 2.5 years. Do you know where you're supposed to be right
yeah,
now?
Yeah. Like, why are you still in the locker room? Everybody left, right? So
Kirk's literally talking right now.
Derek Englund had other things to do. So I was waiting for him in there anyways. And I talked to him after and he's like, Yeah, I had more energy. It conserves our energy in the defensive zone, and it allows you to use those bursts of speed offensively. And I don't think it's something where it's like, okay, yesterday they didn't have any energy in the offensive zone, and tomorrow they will. I think it's a process. I think it's going to take some time. And I think as they play this zone defense more, their legs will start to get a little lighter. They'll start to jump in the offensive into the offensive rush a little more, which I think helps. I think adding a skilled defenseman may help more than that, but...
Okay, I want you to pause on that for a second. And the only reason I want you to pause on that is I want to talk about Mark Stone really quickly.
Yeah.
The production isn't where it needs to be.
Nope.
Mark Stone knows that. He'll be the first one to admit it. Chandler Stephenson is a penalty killer. When Cody Eakin is finally back to health, he is a penalty killer. I understand Mark Stone is the best player on this team. I understand Mark Stone is phenomenal defensively. I understand that Mark Stone has a great stick and he can generate chances shorthanded. I don't like Mark Stone on the penalty kill. When his numbers are as bad as they've been over the last stretch of games, and we're talking about conserving energy, and we're talking about having bursts in the offensive zone, can we get Mark Stone off the damn penalty kill and allow his focus and energy to go into 5-on-5 and power plays? Because as much as we're paying him $9.5 million to be the best player on this team, not we, but collectively the Golden Knights are, they're also paying him to lead this team offensively.
Yeah.
Period.
No, I agree
Full
with
stop,
you.
Period. He needs to be the leader offensively. No one should be challenging him for the lead in points and even goals on this team right now. And they are. He's third, I think. Third or fourth.
Like, I think Carlson and Pacioretty are both above him in points.
Yeah. And it's not that there's any shame in that when you have really good offensive players. But Mark Stone is leaps above those guys and should be leaps above them in terms of production. And when you are relying on him to kill penalties, and oftentimes Mark Stone and whoever are now the first ones over the board to kill a penalty. I just think it's got to stop at some point. You have to give him more chance to play 5-on-5 minutes. I mean, if you get into a game where you're killing 4, 5, 6 penalties in a game, sure, you want to throw him out there a little bit to just keep him going. That's fine. Or if you only want to play him 15, 20 seconds at the end of a penalty kill, that's fine. But you've got to get him away from killing penalties full time.
I agree. And it's got nothing, like you said, it's got nothing to do with him not playing well on the penalty kill. I think he's been great. He doesn't have the foot speed to do what Carlson and Smith do.
No.
Because those two can go all the way to the other end on a 2-on-0 or 2-on-1. And if they don't score, they're fast enough to get back. Whereas Stone, like, just physical limitations, like, he's not going to be able to do that.
Right.
But he's been phenomenal on the penalty kill. But I agree. I think his energy and his resources are better used trying to score, especially, like I said, we talk a lot about the defensemen on this team and how the defense isn't good and how they need to replace a defenseman. And I mean, I'm the one that wrote the story on they need to trade for a defenseman. But this team is the reason they're below 500 right now is because they aren't scoring enough. That's the reason.
Yep.
The goaltending has been good. Both of them have been good. The defensemen haven't been great, but statistically they are good enough. It's the score. They are not scoring enough goals.
So that was my rant on Mark Stone. That's the only thing that I want to say. When you look at his production over the last 15, 16 games, it's not where it needs to be. And I think the easiest way to figure that out is to give him the chance to play just at 5-on-5 and conserve some of that energy for when it really matters, when Mark Stone could put the puck in the back of the net.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're completely spot on with that.
So you mentioned goaltending, and then I promise we'll get to defensemen.
Oh, I'm going to pass up talking about goaltending. Come on, let's talk.
Good point. So Malcolm Subban. All I hear is that you can't judge Malcolm in 5-game stretches because that's too small of a sample size, right? Like, he was good for 5 games, but he was in a rhythm and he's got to learn how to do this on a natural rotation and blah, 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 all this stuff. But all I hear is you can't judge based on 5 games. Can't judge based on five games. It's too small of a sample size. But then those same people can judge him based on one game.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't understand that.
Life of a goalie. You make 30 saves, that's your job. One goes in, you're in trouble. That's like every goal. Now, it's harsher for Subban, but that's when you sign up to be a goalie, that's what you sign up for. Is
sure.
You can do things right 90% of the time, yeah, and nobody cares because that's what you're supposed to do, and then you do the wrong one 1%, 10% of the time, and that's what people hate you for. But it's like, Subban, I mean, 5-on-5 save percentage, Marc-Andre Fleury, 915. Malcolm Subban, 916. Goals against average, Marc-Andre Fleury at 5-on-5, 2.59. Malcolm Subban, 2.52. Goals saved above average, Fleury, 0.87. Subban, 0.91. Every single number you can... high danger save percentage, Marc-Andre Fleury, 0.845. Subban, 0.866. Every single statistic you can possibly pull up, he's been right there with Fleury. Now, he's like a percentage better than Fleury on those. We mm-hmm. all know he's not better than Marc-Andre Fleury. But the point I'm trying to make is that he's right there with him in every single number.
The Rink Rats podcast needs it to be very, very clear. In no way is Jesse suggesting that Marc-Andre Fleury is a worse goaltender.
No.
On the whole... than Malcolm Subban. And at no point in time is Jesse Granger suggesting that the Golden Knights should bench Marc-Andre Fleury.
Or trade him or any other crazy shit.
Or trade him or do anything that would besmirch the good name of Marc-Andre Fleury. We both are here telling you Marc-Andre Fleury is the starter. He's going to be the starter. He deserves to be the starter. He's been incredible for this organization. What happened in Pittsburgh isn't going to happen here in Vegas. So everybody can relax. Yes. But suggesting that Malcolm Subban might be pretty good too does not do anything or take away from Marc-Andre Fleury ever.
Part of the reason I'm so comfortable putting Subban's numbers next to... because I tweet him constantly. And in a bubble, it could look like I'm... saying negative things about Fleury. Part of the reason I'm so comfortable doing that is because I know Fleury is so good that using numbers that say Malcolm Subban's better than him mean nothing to me because I know Fleury is a Hall of Fame. Listen, the Golden Knights can win the Stanley Cup because of one person.
Yeah.
Marc-Andre Fleury. If Mark Stone got hurt tomorrow, the rest of the season, I don't think it's likely they win the Cup, but they could. Mm-hmm. There's not a player on this team that I say they can now not win the Stanley Cup, except for Marc-Andre Fleury. If he's not in the playoffs, the Golden Knights cannot win a Stanley Cup without Marc-Andre Fleury. It cannot be done. I am very confident in saying that.
I agree with you.
So now that we've got that out of the way, he's the best player on the team. He's the most important player on the team. He's the only player on this team that a Stanley Cup 100% hinges on. Sure. Now, Marc-Andre Fleury has been worse than Malcolm Subban statistically in just about every single way possible.
You're lying. Lies.
I don't understand.
I know what I see. It's eye test.
I don't understand.
Cover your five hole. Goalie 101.
Yeah, I don't know what else I can say other than, like, Malcolm Subban is not the reason this team is struggling right now. There are so many reasons this team is struggling, and we've been going over all of them. Goaltending is not one of them.
So, started the year 0-4-2, right?
Malcolm Subban.
0-4-2. He's 4-1-1 in his last six games. It's not good enough. Doesn't matter what he does. Like, I've gotten to the point where it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how good he is. Doesn't matter if he makes a great save. It doesn't matter. It legitimately would not matter to some faction of this fan base, if Malcolm Subban was to win 10 straight games, it wouldn't matter.
With all shutouts.
Because on the 11th game, he'll let in a bad goal or one that people think is bad, and all of a sudden, he's the worst goalie that ever played the game.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, if you even suggest that Malcolm Subban might be a pretty good backup, immediately people jump to, yeah, well, he should be a Hall of Famer.
Why don't you get rid of Fleury then?
And why don't you get rid of Fleury? And why don't you trade him for Ovechkin? Like, geez, guys.
Yeah.
We can talk about him being pretty good at his job. And the last I checked, and I've been around hockey my whole life, so I could be wrong on this. You've been around hockey your whole life. You could be wrong on this too. But last I checked, a backup goaltender doesn't need to be a 9.25 goalie. He doesn't need to be a 9.78 goalie. He doesn't even need to be an 8.85 goalie. You know what a backup goaltender needs to be in the NHL? A goalie that gives you a chance to win.
Yeah.
And how many games has Malcolm Subban been in this year that he has not given the Golden Knights a chance to win?
Man, I think there was one game this year where he let in a couple bad ones early. Yeah. And like, but every goalie does it. And like, what
every
made
single
it,
one?
What made the reaction last night against New York worse was that Georgiev was the other backup goalie on the other side, and he had maybe the best. No, not maybe. I think that was the best game of his entire life.
Since he's
been alive, he's never had a better 60 minutes than that. So everyone's like, man, I hope Subban's taking notes on how to be a backup. If that's how to be a backup goalie, there was 5 expected goals in that game, and he shut them out.
No, listen, you want to take notes on how to be a backup goalie? See Yaroslav Halak.
He's phenomenal.
Maybe the best backup in the league.
Yeah.
Right? You want to... Georgiev's interesting, and I find it really funny that you talk about how comfortable you are putting Malcolm's numbers against Marc-Andre Fleury's numbers because you know how good Marc-Andre Fleury is. I think that the Rangers and their fan base would not be very comfortable with you putting Georgiev's numbers next to Henrik Lundqvist's numbers because they're so much better.
There's
not a number one bona fide in New York. You want to convince yourself that Georgiev's just a backup? You go right ahead. Like, you can believe in that all you want to. He's 1 and 1A right now with Henrik Lundqvist, and that's the truth.
And over the next decade, he's going to be a starting goalie more than he isn't.
Exactly.
So, he's going to be a franchise goalie.
So, Malcolm Subban, pretty good backup. He's going to be a backup. He's got to figure out how to be sharp when he's playing every fourth or fifth game.
It's hard.
That's a difficult thing to do, even for future Hall of Famers. Yeah, it's a difficult thing to do.
It is. But it's backup goalie is a hard position because you get used to practice speed, and then once every couple weeks, you get thrown in there in game speed, and if you're not as good as the future Hall of Famer that's been playing all year, you get trashed. I mean, it's
just nothing.
Listen. Subban's not amazing. Subban hasn't been amazing this season. No, he hasn't. No. Those numbers that I just read off weren't spectacular, but they're good enough for a backup goalie. He's not the problem. He's been, if anything, he's been part of the solution, especially during this winning streak. The guy's making $800,000 a year. Give him a break.
No, I think I'm just convinced that people don't want him to do well. Like, it really grinds their gears when he's playing well.
I will say like that the faction of people who think Subban is the problem has shrunk a lot lately.
No, you're incredibly right. Like, it's not...
It's a very vocal minority.
It's not as prevalent as it's been over the course of the last season or so, but it's unrelenting, and it's almost all the time.
Oh, the other stat that I wanted to say, for those that didn't see the tweet or don't follow me on Twitter, if you think Malcolm Subban's problem is rebound control, it's not. That's just factually incorrect. It's a myth. It's one of those things that, like, an old wives' tale that one person said one time, and then everyone kind of just went with it, and then I'm blanking on. You're looking for something, so then you see it. And every time he gives up a goal that's a rebound, you think, oh, yeah, there it is. He sucks at rebound control. But the stats say differently. This season, Malcolm Subban has allowed rebound shots on 11.3% of his saves. Fleury has allowed rebounds on 13.7% of his saves, so a little bit more. Over all 3 years with the Golden Knights, we're talking all the way back to when Subban was a rookie, all 3 years, Fleury allows rebounds on 11.8% of his shots. Subban, 11.7. They are nearly identical. The rebounds are not an issue. If you think the rebounds are an issue, your eyes are deceiving you.
3.28 goals against, 8.89 save percentage, 3.31 goals against, 8.93 save percentage. That's Martin Jones and Aaron Dell on the season, respectively.
They're in trouble.
They're not good.
I just saw Kevin Kurz, our Athletic Sharks writer, tweet yesterday that in the last 3 games, the Sharks have given up a goal on the first shot, the second shot, and the third shot of each of those games.
Malcolm Subban is a .304 and a .901 save percentage on the season.
Significantly higher than both of them.
He is better than the tandem of goaltending that there is in San Jose. All right, so you wrote a piece. We'll talk about it, and then I think we're going to go to the questions, and then we're going to try to get out of here at a reasonable time. The Golden Knights need a defenseman. We've talked about the Golden Knights needing a defenseman for a long time, at least 2 years now, probably. There's a name that you're going to bring up that's going to feel like deja vu for a lot of listeners of this podcast. And it's funny because all the Golden Knights have actually done since we've talked about them needing a defenseman was trade a defenseman in the mold of what they need in Colin Miller.
Yeah.
So, Jesse, sell me on the Golden Knights needing a defenseman.
So, I mean, they need a defenseman. It's very obvious in the play. But what defenseman they need is the, like, I don't think there's anyone out there that can argue they don't need a defenseman. Like,
they 100% need a defenseman.
It's just, where do you get one when you're as cap strapped as they are without giving up? Because the thing is, like, it's easy to get a defenseman. Offer Riley Smith, Jonathan Marchessault, Max Pacioretty, and you're getting someone back. The issue is, can they get a defenseman without losing the top six forward, the big piece? So I broke it down, and I think it's important to note the nuance of the salary cap. So the Golden Knights don't have a ton of salary cap space, obviously. Every day they're sending Nick Hague and Nick Waugh down to try to get a couple dollars here and there. But this is the way it actually breaks down. So there's 186 days in an NHL season. The salary cap is calculated daily. So you break their salary into 186 pieces, and every day one of those pieces gets counted, which means at the trade deadline, there are only 41 days remaining in the NHL season, which means if you trade for a player on the deadline, February 24th, you only have to pay 41 days worth of their salary, which is roughly 22% of what their cap hit is. So that's important to note. So if you look at a guy and he's got, okay, average annual value of $3 million. The Golden Knights do not have $3 million in cap space, obviously. But 22% of $3 million is only $661,000, meaning the Golden Knights do have the space. Well, they're actually a little bit below that, but they have the space to add someone about $3 million. The equivalent of $2.45 million is what they'll have at the cap. That's the projected, according to Cap Friendly, what they'll have at the cap. So they can spend more than it appears to looking at it on its surface. So I will say that. One guy who I think fits that perfectly, it's just, do you want to go further all in? The Golden Knights have clearly gone all in. They traded Nick Suzuki. They traded Eric Brännström. They've traded first, second, third round pick for Tomas Tatar. Like, they've traded a lot to go all in on this team. If you want to do it one more time, send a first round pick to the Chicago Blackhawks, because Eric Gustafsson is a 27-year-old defenseman who skates like a bat out of hell. Just had an amazing season last year. He was third in the NHL in goals amongst defensemen. We're talking Brent Burns, Mark Giordano, the only two defensemen in the entire NHL who scored more goals last year than Eric Gustafsson. 17 goals and 43 assists. The guy had 60 points last year. So just to put that in Golden Knights perspective, no defenseman in Golden Knights history has ever even come close to 60 points.
Right now, if he were to repeat a 60-point season with the Golden Knights, it's possible he could be the leading scorer on this team by the end of the year.
Yes. Mark Stone is currently on pace to score 61 points. Yep. So this guy is amazing offensively. Now, he's a bit of a liability defensively. I wouldn't say he's useless back there, but he's not going to be a super strong defenseman. But I think you send something Chicago's way, you get... And also, he makes $1.2 million, which is the equivalent of $264,000 of the deadline. So they can fit that easily. They don't even have to ship any salary out in order to bring him in. You could literally trade a first-round draft pick to Chicago, bring him in. You don't have to lose anyone. You keep all of your NHL players, and you add him. The issue is the whole reason he's available right now, because why the hell would any team in their right mind trade a guy who just scored 60 points, who's only making $1.2 million? Well, he's a UFA this summer, and Chicago, from what I've been told, it's almost no chance they sign him. One, because they don't have the money to, and two, because Boqvist is a young defenseman in their system who's in the AHL, and he's tearing it up right now. He's a very similar player, and I think the Blackhawks feel they can let Gustavsson go and replace him with a much cheaper, younger option in Boquist. So McPhee and McCrimmon have been very against rental players. When they wanted to trade for Max Pacioretty, it was contingent on a long-term deal being reached first. Mm-hmm. When they traded for Mark Stone, they wanted a long-term deal. Part of the reason they didn't trade for Erik Karlsson was they couldn't get a long-term deal prior. I don't know if they're willing to do that. I don't know if they're willing to give up another first-round pick and push the chips even further all in. But, man, if you add Erik Gustavsson to this lineup, you can put him with Nate Schmidt, and that is a phenomenal top pairing. And that allows Theodore and McNabb to play together, which, by the way, go look at the numbers. The most efficient defensive pairing for the Golden Knights of any shape or form this year was McNabb-Theodore early in the year. So you put your most efficient line back together with Theodore and McNabb, and you have Gustavsson with Schmidt. Or you can keep McNabb and Schmidt, be your lockdown guys, play them against the top pairings, and then you put Theodore and Gustavsson on the ice in offensive situations. And if I'm opposing team, and the five guys hopping over the boards are Mark Stone, Max Pacioretty, Paul Stastny, Shea Theodore, and Gustavsson, that sounds like a freaking nightmare. So
it's a power play.
There's a lot there. Like, yep. That, there's risk. There's definitely risk. You could lose him. You could be trading a first-round pick to have a guy for a playoff run. But, man, that's tempting.
Is there no piece that can lighten the load of it being a first-round pick? That's, like, is there anything that you're looking at in terms of this roster right now, outside of maybe the top six, outside of Alex Tuck, that Chicago Blackhawks might jump at?
I mean, they'd want Tuck, I tell you that. The Blackhawks,
sure. I mean, a lot of people want Tuck. I feel like Tuck is the one piece you don't even throw in or try to entice anybody with. You've got a gem in that kid.
So the Golden Knights have 5 second-round picks over the next 2 years. So maybe you say 3 seconds. I don't know if that's worse or – I don't know if that's giving up more or giving up less than a first-round pick. Yeah. They have got a ton of second-round picks that they can throw around. They also have Lucas Elvinus, who leads all rookies in the AHL in scoring. Again, you're going all in and giving up your future for something that may not last long. You also have Paul Cotter, who's on his way to winning a Hobie Baker in NCAA right now. So, like, they have pieces that are, but it's like you can't get a 60-point defenseman. And by the way, this guy's 27. He's hitting the prime of his career. You'd have to pay him this summer. From what I gather, he's probably going to be getting $6 to $7 million a year, which would make him the highest paid defenseman on the Golden Knights.
Can they? We'll have to look at cap friendly. So, like, let's hear the other names. So I'm intrigued by Gustavsson simply because he's been impressive every time the Golden Knights have played the Chicago Blackhawks. He's very noticeable with the puck. He's incredibly natural in the offensive zone.
He's phenomenal.
And now I'm like giddy with excitement. But again, he has holes in his game.
He's gonna blow coverages and give up goals, and people are gonna hate him for a second.
That's fine. The difference is, like, Gustavsson is what he is. Like, we know what he is, right? Yeah. Like, we know that he's an offensive guy who doesn't necessarily play a whole ton of defense. Like, that's fine. I get it. Shea Theodore got a lot of criticism because he was sacrificing defense for offense. But what Shea Theodore's done this year, more than any other year with the Golden Knights, is he's been solid defensively and he's not sacrificing. Like, there was that brief period in time
when Schmidt was out.
Yeah, where Shea Theodore could have gone one of two ways. He could have been like Gustavsson and just been an offensive guy and just said, screw it, I don't really care about defending or whatever. But I think he's been nudged in the right direction in terms of being a little bit more responsible defensively, and it's hurt his offensive game. I think it's time for the Golden Knights to just go out there and say, you know what? We need a guy that can put some pucks toward the net, on net, get some points on the board from the defense, and if we got to live with a goal or two against over the course of a 5-game, 6-game stretch, he's going to put up like 8 or 10 points, so we'll be fine.
He's really good. So, next option. I think this is a little more the Golden Knights style, just because McPhee and McCrimmon value defensive responsibility. This is a guy who can add offense, not nearly at the level of Gustavsson, but is very good in his own end, and that's Marco Scandella, Buffalo Sabres defenseman. He's 30 years old. He's in the exact same situation as Gustavsson in that he's a UFA. The Sabres have younger, cheaper defensemen who are going to fill his spot I've been told it's unlikely they re-sign Scandella, so they're going to be looking to move him for something. It's not going to be like they're not as willing to get rid of him as the Blackhawks are Gustafson, because the Sabres aren't in last place. Mm-hmm. So the Sabres could use Scandella in a playoff run. The Blackhawks can't use Gustafson in a playoff run because they're in last place. So you may have to do a little more to pry him away. But the stat that kind of blew me away with Scandella is I don't see the Sabres as a terribly as a really good defensive team. They have holes defensively, mm-hmm. but out of 166 defensemen in the NHL this year with at least 300 minutes of ice time, Scandella ranks second in goals against per 60 minutes while he's on the ice. So on a team that's not great defensively, his numbers are fantastic defensively. And he's not just one of those guys that the shooting percentage is crazy low against him. He's 22nd in the NHL in shot share. He's 25th in scoring chance share. He's in the top 25 in most defensive statistics. So Scandella is a guy who he's never going to score 60 points, but he scores 20 to 30 points a season, which is more than what most of the Golden Knights defensemen score. So he can pitch in offensively, but he's solid in his own end. A guy that, again, slots right into the top four. You can put him with Schmidt. You can put him with Theodore. You can put him with whoever you want.
Question I have is, don't you want to make a bit more of a splash? You're looking for offense from your defense. I think that's what the Golden Knights are looking for. They're looking for mobility in terms of getting pucks in and out of their own zone, and they're looking for offense from the defense. And while Scandella, as you mentioned, good in his own zone, I mean, the Golden Knights have enough guys that are good in their own zone. They play in their own zone too much. That's the problem. You know what I mean?
It's not just that, though. So he's been on the ice for 20 even strength goals this season.
Okay.
That's really good.
Yeah.
And only 9 against.
Okay.
On even strength. This guy, I don't think, when I say Scandella's good in his own zone, I don't picture, I'm not saying he's Braden McNabb good in his own zone. I think he carries play. I think when Marco Scandella's on the ice, the puck is more likely to be in the offensive zone than it is the defensive zone.
I guess the question is, how much does it move the needle?
Right? I think he's more Nate Schmidt than he is.
I want to see the Golden Knights do something that's different on their defense.
Yeah.
It's been the same thing for 2.5 years.
Like I said, this is more the Golden Knights style. This is more what they do.
I think you're absolutely right in making that assumption. If I'm handicapping this right now, Scandella is the front runner because it fits the mold of what the Golden Knights have always done. I want to see them get outside of that box a little bit. That's the only thing for me. I would much rather defensive liabilities and 60 points from a player than, he's going to chip in here and there offensively. We don't know that in this system.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the thing. I look at Gustafson and I'm I don't really give a shit what system he's in. He's probably going to put up points.
Yeah.
Cause that's what he does. Yep. You're paying for that. You're going to get it. With Scandella, you might get it. You might not.
That's
because you don't know how he's going to be defensively.
He's not dynamic.
Exactly. And I think that's what's missing for the Golden Knights. But as I say this, you're probably right. It'll probably be Scandella because that's status quo.
Also, he's not going to cost a first round pick. Scandella is a good player who's probably going to be gone. I think you could get him for a second, maybe even a third, because they're going to have to send some slight salary back because
do they have honey in Buffalo?
The honey to protect?
Yes.
Ryan Reeves?
Yes. Maybe.
I don't know, but so Scandella, you'd have to send a little bit back because he's making 3.875, and I think I said that they have room for the equivalent of 2 point something. So they'd have to send a very small amount back to Buffalo.
Sure.
In order to make that deal, but I think you could get away with much. You're not going all in again. If they go for Gustafson, you're going all again, just 100%. Like you did with Pacioretty, just like you did with Stone. So if they don't want to do that again, the middle ground is Scandella. The next guy on the list is a guy who's been talked about quite a bit, and that's Sammy Vatanen, New Jersey Devils offensive defenseman. The guy's already got 4 goals and 9 assists this year.
The Devils are an absolute train wreck, and they are looking to sell.
Yes, they are looking to sell. So and by the way, another guy who is highly unlikely to be re-signed, so he's probably going to leave for nothing this summer. What I was impressed with was his defensive numbers. I was terrified to look at because the Devils are so bad defensively, and Sammy Vatanen isn't a defensive defenseman. So I assumed when I go on there and I look at his defensive numbers, it's going to be ugly. And it actually wasn't that bad. 39th in goals against per 60 minutes. The 39th out of 166 defensemen. Top 40 on a team in that is, I think, let's see.
They're abjectly terrible. They are terrible.
They've allowed the fourth most even strength goals in the NHL, and he's 39th out of 166. So solid defensive stats for a guy who's on a team that gives up a ton of goals. And his defense isn't what you're getting him for. It hits his offense. And he, again, not as dynamic as Gustafson, but he is very Shea Theodore-esque, right? I mean, he's dynamic. When he has the puck, you notice.
I like Vatanen. I feel like Vatanen's the safer play between Gustafson. Like, he's almost Gustafson and Scandella in one.
He's kind of the middle ground. So Vatanen has topped 20 points in five of his last six seasons. The one where he didn't, he only played 50 games because he was hurt. So basically, he's good for 20-something. Maybe he can possibly get over 30. Now, that's not 60.
No.
It's totally different realm. Now, but also, Vatanen's done this for 6 years.
Yeah.
Gustafson has one season. Gustafson is the William Karlsson of defensemen. He is 27, and he had his one big year last year, and this year he's been okay. It's kind of like William Karlsson last season. He's not going to hit the 60 points again, but he's been good. So Vatanen is a little safer. He's got a more of a track record. I think the Golden Knights would probably be more comfortable giving Vatanen a long-term deal if they were able to, like this summer, they might have to lose a couple guys again because of the cap, but I think they're more comfortable signing him to a long-term deal just because he has more of a track record to work off of.
Last defenseman on the list. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you've got two more. You've got two more.
The next one is Shane Gostisbehere from the Philadelphia Flyers. And the reason he doesn't fit in with the rest of these other three is because the first three had one thing in common. They're all UFAs. And they're all probably not being re-signed. So their team needs to get rid of them if they're not going to lose them for anything. Gostisbehere still has 3 years left on his deal at 4.5, which is extremely reasonable for someone as good as him.
Yep.
He's making less than Schmidt, less than Theodore, and he is arguably as good or better than both of them. He's a really good defenseman. And the only reason, so he's good. He's only 26. They've got 3 years left. Why the hell would they trade this guy?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but for some reason, the Flyers don't like him. He's been relegated to the, after playing 19 minutes a game last year, he's been relegated to the third pair, and last week he was scratched three times.
He was really good as a rookie. I think he was better as a sophomore, and then the wheels kind of fell off a bit, and he just hasn't been able to recreate that, but it's happened. And it's happened on lesser teams than what the Golden Knights have. So I would kick the tires on Gostisbehere. I think that there's potential to not have to give up a whole heck of a lot to get him.
See,
now, simply because the Flyers are looking to make a hockey trade.
Exactly. That's the biggest difference. And like I wrote that, like, unlike the other three where you can just give them draft picks, Flyers are going to want a top six forward back, or Alex Tuch, which I'll just consider him. The Golden Knights have seven top six forwards. The Flyers are going to, because they currently have the sixth best record in the NHL. They are way above the Golden Knights in the standings. They are not tanking. They are not getting rid of guys, especially guys who they have under contract for 3 years,
right,
for draft picks. So it's, if you want Gostisbehere, it's going to have to be Marchessault, Smith. It's going to have to be a top six player, and I don't think the Golden Knights are willing to do that, but you never know.
I'm trying to figure out if there's a way I could be talked into that. I'll think about it. I don't think I could go or see Gostisbehere for Marchessault, Smith. I don't think I can see. I could see, this is going to be unpopular, but like I could see, I would be okay with Gostisbehere for Stastny.
Glass slots in there when he comes back, yep. Yeah.
And then you allow Cody Eakin third line. You've got Chandler Stephenson. That opens up some possibilities. Yeah. Like, I could talk myself into Gostisbehere for Stastny straight up.
And that would be something that maybe the Flyers would be interested in. I mean, you get a veteran center who can,
On a team that needs a little bit more down the middle. I mean, you know, they've got enough right now, but they're not going to have enough in the playoffs. So, I think I can get my head around that and be okay with that.
And the salaries match, like that, Stastny makes more than Gostisbehere, so that would, the salary-wise, it would work.
Sure.
But yeah, so that one is a totally different trait. Like, it feels totally different because you're losing a part of this year's team, whereas the other ones, I think you can just get away with futures. Right. And then the final guy on the list is completely different than the rest of them, because this is the guy who I included on this list because if George McPhee and Kelly McCrimmon are sitting in their war room and the deadlines, the hours are ticking down, and it's like, you know what? I don't think we're willing to give up a first or 2 seconds or Paul Stastny or a top 6-4. I don't think we're willing to do that. But you still want to just add something? I think they can get Mike Green from the Detroit Red Wings for free. I honestly think
future considerations.
We're talking sixth round pick. Because listen, so Mike Green, if for those that don't know, Mike Green was George McPhee's best offensive defenseman on the Capitals for the majority of that run before when they weren't able to break through to the
when
Cup.
They didn't win Stanley Cups.
Yeah. He was phenomenal for them and he was a machine. Like the guy had
He was like John Carlson.
Yeah.
Before the guy, John Carlson was John Carlson. Just,
the guy had 113 goals and 247 assists in 575 games for the Capitals. So, like, he was an offensive machine. Now, he's 34. Those days are over.
Yep.
He is no longer an offensive machine. He's a specialist who can really help on the power play. And I think he's 34. He's a UFA at the end of the year. So you always ask yourself, like, when you're trying to make a trade, what is this guy worth to the team he's currently on? The Detroit Red Wings are clearly tanking. They have nothing to play for this season. The Detroit Red Wings have absolutely nothing to play for this season. They are completely in future mode. So Mike Green means nothing to them this season. Well, what about going forward? Well, he's a UFA at the end of the year, and it's highly unlikely he's going to re-sign with Detroit, who's in a rebuild. So he's basically worthless to the Red Wings. Not that he's not a good player, but even if he scores 10 goals for them, it actually hurts their franchise because they're trying to lose. So this team has absolutely no use for Mike Green. So I think McPhee could go in. He's got a good rapport with Green. He played for him for basically his whole career in Washington. You go in there, you get it's extremely cheap. Mike Green comes to the Golden Knights where maybe his offensive instincts and his offensive maybe they can be accentuated in Vegas, because in Detroit they've got one line that's really good. And those guys are awesome, but the rest of that lineup is AHL worthy. And you get an offensive defenseman like Mike Green, who's not in the prime of his career. He can't single-handedly make plays anymore. He's relying on his forwards a lot, and he just can't make it happen. So I think if he were to, and also it's rejuvenating to you're back with McPhee. You're with a team that's supposed to be a contender. Maybe he plays better than he has the last couple years in Detroit. And like I said, it's a win-win because you're not going to give up anything to get him.
If I'm ranking them in terms of what I can see happening because of the Golden Knights, I can see Scandella. I don't know if I can get my head to Goss Despair, because I think that would be the piece that needs to go back. It would be Stastny. He's got one more year, right?
Yep.
So that's a tough one, but I think from a fit perspective and from a Golden Knights not selling the future anymore perspective, that's the trade I think I might like the most. But man, I'm all in on Gustafson. Like let's go. Like let's get ready. Let's do it. Let's go.
It's enticing. And again, this is one of those trades that if you don't end up signing him long term, if he leaves in free agency and you gave up a first round pick for him and you lost in the first round,
yep,
that stings. It's a risky trade, because if you give up a first round pick and you don't sign him long term and he leaves and you don't make a deep cup run, man, that you just set a first round pick on fire, essentially.
Okay. So real quick, we are up against it. However, I do want to get to at least one question. There was one question that I thought was really, really good, and one that we haven't spent a whole heck of a lot of time talking about today. Eric Vegas VGK says, should the refs do post game pressers like the coaches do? I'm just kidding, sorta. You don't need to qualify this in any way, shape, or form. They absolutely should. Yes. If a ref blows a call, they should have to answer to it. Like if Gerard Gallant blows a call, or if he does something that, you know, you question or you wonder why this, that, or the other thing, he has to answer to those things. The players have to answer to him. The referee should be no different. The referee should have to answer to what they saw or why they made a determination on the ice. If it's right, wrong, and different, it doesn't matter. They should be held accountable by having to answer those types of questions post-game.
I could not agree more. And we're obviously on a much smaller scale, but throw the media in there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Players, you make a mistake, you have to answer for it after the game. Coach, you make a coaching error, you have to answer for it after the game. The general manager, if he makes a bad trade or drafts a bust in the first round, you have to answer for it. If I report something that's false, I have to answer for it. If I tweet this player is getting traded and all of a sudden he doesn't get traded, I don't get to just hide. And like, I have to come out and say and speak for what is that. Now, luckily that hasn't happened, but
give it time.
Yeah, give it some time. But we and like the reason it hasn't happened is because I have to answer to, like, the reason I haven't reported anything false is because every single tweet I make, every single report I make, everything I write, I have to answer for that, and I know I have to answer for it, so I'm being extremely careful, which is what you want the referees to do. They should have to answer for it 100%.
Completely agree. This one from Steve LaRusso. Should we start worrying about Stastny's production? Yes, about 15 games ago.
It's not been good. How many games has he
21
gone?
21 games without an assist.
That is
for
insane.
A guy that is a specialist in terms of setting up his teammates and plays, well, I mean, there was a stretch where he was playing on the third line, but he plays with two elite scorers.
It's absolutely unacceptable for him to go that long without an assist.
This is a guy we never answer his question, so I hope that you enjoy this. Legal Paddy Wagon, Patrick Harrington. Think we'll call someone new from the AHL, or is it going to be Wah again? I'd be shocked if it wasn't Wah, simply because the Golden Knights are working his cap hit into what they're doing for the deadline. I don't see them calling up another player. I think it's going to be Wah.
It's going to be Wah, partially because he's been good when he's been there. I think he's better really than Nosek. I think he's been good.
Chew and Judas. How much more of Nick Hague's game, growth potential-wise, do you guys think we will see this season in the NHL? Can he be the type of player that near single-handedly dominates a game in the NHL? I don't think he is a dominant defenseman. I don't think he's the type of guy that's going to be able to take a game over by any stretch. I think that offensively, he's going to be someone that chips in here and there. I do think once pucks go in for him, you might see an uptick there. But you know, once he gets a little bit more physical in terms of challenging gaps and challenging zone entries, I think he can be a scary defenseman to play against. But I think Nick Hague's going to be a 3-4 guy probably his entire career. I don't think he's a number one or number two defenseman. I think he's going to be right on that second pair. Maybe he can fill in at times depending on who his partner is on a top pairing, but I think he's a middle pair defenseman, and that's what he's going to be.
Yeah, I think when you talk about like room for growth this season, I think the offense is where the growth is. Like he's grown defensively a ton, and I think he's pretty much to where he's going to be like this year, not for his career, but I think this year you've pretty much seen defensively he's getting better. His stick is good. He's been using his body a little more, but offensively he's still terrified to lose the puck. So when the puck comes back to him at the blue line, he isn't confidently skating around guys. He isn't confidently firing it on net. He's very, very, very careful with it because he doesn't want to fire it into a guy's shins and then have it be a breakaway on the other end. So he's being a little too careful, and I think the more games he plays, the more comfortable he gets. He's already done one toe drag that led to a goal. It wasn't his goal, but he's already done that one, and like that's his move.
His move, yeah.
He was in Junior, you saw it every time when we watch him at training camp, in the rookie camp, that's what he does to everyone. In the AHL, he was doing it to everyone. In the NHL, he doesn't because he's terrified that when he does that toe drag, it gets poked away and the guy's gone the other way.
Yeah.
The more comfort he gets in the offensive zone, the more he'll start doing things like that. And that's where he's dangerous. And he's not going to score a bunch of goals, but he can get the puck into dangerous areas. So I do think there's room for growth in the offensive zone.
He's a taller Colin Miller.
Yeah, he's a taller, but without, he's already as good defensively.
Without the wheels.
He's already as good defensively as Colin Miller, in my opinion.
Sure, but he's not as good offensively.
No, he's certainly
not. And he might get there, but again, I don't know, man. I want some offense from the defense.
Yeah.
Like, that's Brad Hunt, Colin Miller. Brad Hunt.
Brad Hunt.
You laugh.
He currently has more goals and more points than any defenseman on the Golden Knights.
You laugh, but it's legit. Anyway, Jesse, what are you working on this week? Where can people find your stuff?
TheAthletic.com/Granger for 50% off.
50? Is it always 50?
I think it's always 50. Is it 40? Maybe I don't even know my own deal.
Screw it up?
I don't even know my own deal. It's some percent off, I promise.
You get you save off of the full price.
Yes.
You're going to have to answer to that one.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to have to answer to it. Yeah, unlike the referees, unlike Dan O'Halloran. So What am I working on this week? I'm going to have a story coming up on, so serious note, a lot of accusations by players on coaches around the NHL. Yep. Obviously, Babcock was the one that started it all, but Bill Peters lost his job over some serious, serious actions that he did way back. And
being
also,
a complete jackass.
Yes, yep. Yes, yeah. He's being a piece of shit.
Yes.
Got him fired.
100%.
And then you have Crawford in Chicago, same thing is happening. I spoke with some Golden Knights players about how Gerard Gallant is the complete opposite of that. And Gerard Gallant had some great quotes on it also. So that'll be coming up this week. Also, man, I can't even remember
That's
anything
it.
That I'm working on. That's it. Nothing else. That's it on The Athletic.
All right. We should be back next week. The Golden Knights do play at home a couple of games, so we'll probably try to get another one of these out next Monday. But until then, you can catch me Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m. on Fox Sports Las Vegas with Frank Harnish for the VGK Insider Show. And for every pregame, intermission, and postgame report for the Golden Knights, we'll be back with you next week. Again, seriously, is there honey in Buffalo?
Someday.
Porsche.